The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's Heretics Hour. It is already October 29th, 2012. And I'm coming to you from the White Network, and we have a very interesting, if not very upbeat, maybe, show tonight for you. I say we because my good friend Hadding Scott is here with me again tonight to help me deal with this subject. Hi, Hadding. Glad to have you aboard.
Thank you.
We're going to be, the tentative title of tonight's show is Sadists and Masochists, Torture of Nazi Prisoners. Well, it was inspired by some recent articles in British newspapers about a book coming out by a man named Ian Cobain about revelations of what was taking place in the cage in London where they were holding German prisoners during the war and then after the war. And other places also after the war, during the war, and in Germany after the war, and the terrible kind of treatment that these, really shockingly terrible, that these German prisoners received. And I wanted to talk about that in a larger picture, the larger viewpoint of this propaganda, this anti-Nazi, anti-German propaganda that has been going on, that is built up all the time and constantly repeated, particularly by the British and by the Jews and the Jewish press. It seems to be no abatement in it. And when something like this comes out, it should make a difference, but it usually doesn't. So this is my complaint and also what I want to bring out very strongly tonight. And last Saturday, Vincent Renoir was on my Saturday afternoon program just 2 days ago, and he brought up the subject of sadists and masochists, and what I thought was I couldn't help but giggle about it, of how talking about human rights, that if you, whatever anybody wants to do, if they're not hurting someone else, they're free to do it. And he was using the example of masochists say that they like being tortured by sadists, and they want to be, and all, then the sadists can go ahead and do that if they want, because this is the way it is in a society where every individual has the right to do what they want as long as they're not hurting somebody else. So I'm kind of playing on that, carrying that over from Saturday, and using the term sadists and masochists tonight with the idea that that the Germans have been turned into a masochistic society, because I think if you're treated brutally by sadists for long enough, you come to expect it, you come to almost agree with it, and you accept that that what is being done is the way it should be, and so on. So we'll get into that. First, I want to open up with a couple of stories and tell you that we've got a phone line, and the number to call is 1-830-443-4911. I have to tell you, it's not toll free. It will be on your phone bill, but you can call, but I would ask you to wait until the second hour, because then in the second hour we will take calls, and as many of them come, if they come. And I also have the mail, the email at carolyn@carolynyeager.com open. So I'll be looking at that too. Well, now, Hadding, again, thanks for being here. And I wanted to bring up a couple of late breaking stories before we get started into this heavy topic. And one is that, quite humorously, I think, since we do the Thursday night, the International Jew Study Hour show, and we've been discussing the protocols for quite a few weeks now, I'm about done with that, and we have a difference of opinion about that, but that's not what's important here. What's kind of humorous is that the story that just came out that in Greece, where the Golden Dawn Party is, you know, making some headway, and most white nationalists and are, you know, cheering them on, and one of their members of parliament stood up in the Greek parliament, and in his argument, he read from the Protocol 19 from the book, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and when he did, it was reported later by the Jewish press, by Haaretz, and they were really upset, especially because there was no reaction in the parliament. He read it, nobody said anything. I guess he said where it was from, and nobody said anything afterwards, and still hadn't, and they were just furious, and they came out with a written statement from B'nai B'rith Europe and said that this reading in an EU parliament was a sign of moral corruption and degradation, which must not be overlooked. And the fact that there was silence about it was doubly worrisome. And they wanted somebody to protest it, you know, say something about it. So that's all I know. So far, nothing has been said. And the other thing is that members of members of Hungary's Jobbik party, but these are just members, the ultra-nationalist party in Hungary, had a little demonstration and burned an Israeli flag in front of a major synagogue in the capital, and they called on the government to cut diplomatic and economic ties with the Tel Aviv regime. And the Jobbik said, I don't know. Jobbik leader wasn't there, I don't think, but he has said that he has denounced Hungary's cooperation with the Israeli regime and said any agreement between Hungary and Israel should be canceled. So naturally, the Israeli ambassador got on TV and was condemning that. And, that's in the news now. So, what do you have any comment on either of those?
That guy that read the Protocol 19, that's the same one that slapped the woman during the TV show.
Yeah, right. It says so in the story that he is.
Okay.
But as I told you, there's a picture of him there, and he's really a good-looking guy. The ideal kind of, National Socialist warrior fighter. He doesn't look like a stupid brute or anything, but I guess he's just not going to take anything from anybody. Anyway,
he doesn't have much self-control, does he?
Well,
I think he's a little short on prudence.
Well, possibly, but sometimes I think we don't want to be so awfully prudent, and that's part of the way I feel about tonight's program. That I'm really fed up. I'm really tired of being careful about what's said, and these kind of things that have come out that do come out about the British, about the Americans, about the Russians, and so on. They don't seem to make any headway when it comes to continuing the false narrative of World War II and all the falsehoods about German and Nazi atrocities against people. And so let's get into that. Another theme of Saturday's program was, what is that called? Logical consequence of ideas. And we're going to kind of get into that, but this other story may not allow us too much time for it. But the logical consequence of ideas, one example I have, because I've been reading Alfred Rosenberg's book, The Track of the Jew Through the Ages, and I only have a little bit left now. And I have some quotes that I can use later on if I can fit them in. But, one point that comes out from this, and from other things too, but Rosenberg is very, very clear about it. Now, I'll start out by saying that I really like Alfred Rosenberg, and he is not a Jew. 20 people who might think that name, as some people say, oh, Alfred Rosenberg, a big Nazi Jew. Well, Rosenberg, as you know, Hadding, better than I do, is a German name, right?
Yeah. Well, see, he's a Baltic German, and in the Baltic states, Rosenberg is a fairly common, or was a fairly common name for Germans. In the rest of Germany, it's not so common, but in the Baltic, I had a landlady that was from Latvia, so I know this. In the Baltic states, that was a fairly common German name, and that's
well. That's good to know. I didn't know that particular fact. So that he was a wonderful German, and he was a wonderful National Socialist to my mind. And even though he was there right in the beginning, I mean, he was early. In fact, I think he was had a friend and in the circle of Dietrich Eckart before Hitler even showed up. And when Eckart met Hitler, he was very impressed and said, "This is, you know, kind of this is the man who can lead us." And but Rosenberg was always there, and he was always very committed to National Socialism and to Hitler, and very loyal. Even though later on he was not one of Hitler's favorites, and Hitler sometimes joined in with kind of making fun of him, because Alfred Rosenberg was a very serious guy, and he wrote long, involved stuff, and Hitler sometimes just liked to have a good laugh. And he wasn't interested in reading all of, he didn't think much of the myth of the 20th century, which is Rosenberg's famous one, but I always wanted to read it, and I did read it, and I liked it, and I like everything I read from Rosenberg. I just like him. So, he makes it very clear in his writings that the Jews are opposite in nature to Germans. And I agree with that. And there are a lot of people, and even Germans, who try to say that they can get along so well, you know, they're so similar. Oh, they're wonderful together, make a wonderful culture, Judaic German culture, and so on, which I think is just horrendous. So, but to Rosenberg, the logical conclusion of this idea, well, I don't know. He says it, but anybody would say it. The logical conclusion to the idea that Jews and Germans are opposite is to separate the two people, which is what the National Socialists tried to do. That's basically what it was all about. But the Jews fight against both the idea that, that the Jews and Germans are opposites, and they fight against the logical conclusion that they need to be taken out of German society, because of course they want to be in German society just like they want to be in our society, so they can live off of us and parasite, you know, live their parasitical existence and so on. But now, you know, I can't stay with, because I want to talk about the British tonight. So you're gonna explain why we're not trying to be anti-British, but you know, I have a tendency to be angry at the British, but not all the good British people who support what I'm doing and so on. but the British, the British state, the British elite and so on, and British establishment. And first, you know, they are good allies of the Jews. And some points that I could make, and then I'll let you take over. That English culture developed as highly competitive. You know, to me, this is my impression of the English. They want to win, you know, and they're also very commercial minded, and trade, and import, export, etc. was real important. And they want to, you know, win in the commercial area too, and in money making, and they're highly class conscious, so that they have the better people versus the common people. But you know, it seems to me that the English have a history of relying on deception. They're big on cover up. You know, they really keep a lot of secrets. They have no problem.
They used to be called perfidious Albion, or Albion perfide in French, because they were so dishonest and.
Well, there you go. See, so it's
no
secret.
Side with somebody and then switch sides.
Ah.
When it was opportune.
Yeah. So they have no problem with being lying hypocrites, I'm saying. A little more blunt than what you're saying. But in simple, or simply being in denial, they're in denial, or maybe they just present, you know, they're either really, sometimes they're really in denial, they have to be, or they just are able to, they want to present themselves and hide the stuff that they don't want people to know about, and they're good at doing that, and they're not, don't seem to be too troubled with guilt feelings. Even the British common people are so infused with the idea that of the great British history and tradition and freedom and laws to protect freedoms and so on, that they have a hard time feeling guilty, and they don't feel very guilty, except now they've been made to feel guilty about colored people, but not about other Europeans, you know, what they've done in terms of dealing with other Europeans. And they know how to justify everything as self-defense, and we can talk about that in this article. And they have no problem with bullying. They tend to be bullies, I think, to those who are smaller or weaker than them. But then at the same time, they make big shows of the opposite of that. But
yeah. That kind of ethos about how the stronger should have their way, it seems to go with plutocracy. The idea that whoever has the power, you know, ought to be allowed to do whatever he can get away with, more or less.
Oh, very good. Because my next 2 points here, I just got three more. That, you know, rather than being so heroic, you know, when they are in battles and wars and so on, they more depend on secretive and dirty operations, like what we call today black ops. But, you know, doing these underhanded things, which take a lot of intelligence. That's why it's called intelligence, of the enemy's weaknesses and so on. And they do it that way. And so they use a lot of very deep intelligence, which they never want to have uncovered. And there's a lot of that still from World War One and World War Two, that they don't. They still have a lot of documents and so on, and that are nobody has seen. They're still not allowed to be. They're still not released. You know, they don't. Because, well, we'll talk about that. Okay, and then they have to practice projection in order to, you know, put their own wrongdoing onto their enemy. And, well, they certainly do that with the Germans, and that's my main focus tonight. So, yeah. You know, they really project, as do the Jews. And the Americans are doing it, too. They're also a Jewish-run nation, so... But, I mean, maybe just the Americans themselves did that from the beginning anyway. And the British have a worldwide intelligence network still. I think the British do excel in intelligence and spying and so on. And, well, mainly figuring out how to undermine the other side, which is why I call it black ops, some things like that. So that's my introductory comments. Go ahead with the plutocracy.
I think in a society where the government depends to some extent on public voting,
mm-hmm.
In order to get a war started, assuming that there's an elite that's trying to manipulate the public and get things done the way they want, regardless of the public's interest, if they want to get a war started, they have to tell the public some kind of lies to get the public to support the war. So they tell some outrageous inflammatory lies. You know, the Germans want to do this or that. Saddam Hussein gassed his own people and tried to kill George Bush. Stuff mm-hmm. like this. And they keep saying that kind of stuff long enough until ordinary people feel this guy's really a monster. And at that point, you've got carte blanche to go over there, and anybody that supports this monster just deserves whatever he gets.
Yeah, but the point is, what about those who are doing that? Why do they want war so much? Why, you know, we know that they are manipulating their own people with propaganda.
Well, I was just addressing the point of why democratic propaganda is so vicious.
Yeah.
Because you've got to motivate those ordinary people, especially if you're trying to get them to do something that's against their interest. You've got to tell them things that are just blindingly shocking. to get them to do that.
But the British have done this more than anyone else, probably. I mean, look at smaller countries in Europe. They don't engage in that in the way that Britain has, because Britain has wanted to be the single most powerful leading nation, right?
I'm not really an expert on the other countries there.
Well, we don't hear about it.
Yeah.
So this is something peculiarly kind of British because of their great ambition, the strength of their, they are strong and very smart people. They are very, very capable, and they have done a lot, and they want to keep their leading position. And they feel that to do that, they have anything goes kind of, but they don't want to admit to the world that anything goes for them. So they keep it a secret. That's kind of the simple way of putting it.
I think another aspect of that is that Britain sacrificed so much and lost so much in the Second World War that if you take the moral coloration out of it, it really looks like a horrendous disaster. And at that point, what do British people have of which to be proud? Because I remember seeing Stephen Ambrose in the last installment of The World at War, which you can find. I have a link to it on my blog, actually. And he says that Britain sacrificed an awful lot in the Second World War. They basically lost their empire in the Second World War.
Yes.
And became.
But why did they? I mean, the point is. Well, go ahead and make your point.
Well, the only thing they have to show for it is a kind of a moral blue ribbon. This
well, that's
was our finest
yeah.
hour. Oh yeah, yeah, Whoopee, you did good. Well, what if they didn't do good? Then you have what, despair?
Well, then the
whole
thing
is because they wasted everything.
Then,
they did terrible
things.
Then
the whole thing will come out in the open, which is what needs to happen, because they're trying to keep this going. This false history going, you know, with their bravery or whatever and covering up what they really, how they really accomplished things. Apart from that is, why did they want to go to war to begin with? Why were they so hot to go to war with Germany? Which we know truthfully that they were, and it's just the false narration that says that Germany was aggressively going after Britain, which was never a desire of any of the Germans.
Yeah, well, if you go back to the 19th century, big problem that Britain was a declining economic power for most of the 19th century because of the rise of both the United States and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And Germany, especially in the late 19th century. So basically, the British wanted to eliminate an economic competitor.
Well, exactly. There you go. That's what they were trying to do, and that goes back to what I was saying, that maybe not all that well, I wasn't saying it, but that they're highly competitive. They want to win. They want to, you know, beat out also in, you know, in trade and stay the richest and so on. And so they have to beat their enemies, and they do it with deception and lying and bullying and various, you know, black intelligence operations and so on. And that is the truth about Britain's role in World War II, not this shining hour that they put on, right?
Yes.
But people are so unwilling, they're so brainwashed, and they're so partial to the English, and so
prejudiced
against the Germans that they were not open to this.
The First World War was about eliminating an economic competitor on Britain's part. The Second World War, and I'm taking this from Hamilton Fish, FDR, the other side of the coin. Second World War was motivated largely through financial pressure from the United States, because Britain's loans were apparently in the hands of New York City banks, and they could get better, you know, they could get leniency or not get leniency depending on whether they cooperated. That's my understanding anyway. And Chamberlain went along with the pressure from the United States. And even after Britain had pushed France into declaring war and declared war itself on Germany, they didn't really think they were going to fight a real war. That's why there was this, what they called Sitzkrieg for months.
Even after they declared
war, they weren't really serious about it. Actually, France and Britain had had enough from the First World War, but they got pushed into it by the United States.
Well, what kind of shape was Britain in financially in the 1930s, you know, pre-war?
What I've read is that Britain actually went from the First World War straight into the Great Depression. That's what Lawrence Dennis says.
And they never got out of it, except through war. Well, they didn't even get out of it through war, but the United States did.
Yeah. I don't know the economic history of Britain that well.
Okay. Well, let's move. That's about as much preliminary we can do. Let's go into this article. And actually, it's a book by Ian Cobain, which is not out yet, but it's soon to be released. And it is the title of it. I have to go down here to make sure I got this right. The title of it is Cruel Britannia. Cruel Britannia. It's published by Portobello Books. You know, it's going to be £18.99. And you can order your copy. Now, you can even put in an order at Amazon, but it's not, they don't even have a picture of the cover yet. But somehow people have gotten hold of it, and even though Ian Cobain works for the Daily, for the Guardian, and the Daily Mail has published a long article about, with excerpts. It's actually taken extracts from the book, which they call, he wrote some articles, The Secrets of the London Cage, in November 2005, Ian Cobain. He's been investigating this for a long time. But now this book is coming out, but it doesn't deal only with World War II and the German prisoners of war. It deals with other things too. So this would just be a part of it, I would assume. But this is the part that we have the extracts from. And as I say, some of this has come out. A lot of this did come out in 2005. And this is the point that, you know, once again, people are going to say, and even some commenters, writing comments, have said about this, well, the Germans, that's old history, and we don't care about them anymore. And what about what's going on now? See, they just want to keep sweeping this thing about the World War II false narrative under the rug. So I will, what I'm going to do, I guess, I'm going to just read some of these extracts and we can comment on them, Hadding. He says, you know, Britain has a reputation as a nation that prides itself on its love of fair play and respect for the rule of law. We claim the moral high ground when it comes to human rights. And, I just say both of the opposite of that is true. He says, goes right.
That's an ironic statement there.
Yeah, right. Well, he means it to be ironic, actually, though, because he's saying this is what the British have been trying to do. But what I'm going to reveal here tells a different story. He goes right into this thing. I'm not going to start that way. I'm going to start with, they say that the British were the first. We were among the first to sign the 1929 Geneva Convention on the humane treatment of prisoners of war. And what's revealed here is that they did not follow the Geneva Convention at all with these German prisoners, and they try to keep that secret. So he says that during my work as an investigative reporter, I came across a veiled mention of a World War II detention center known as the London Cage. I just hate that word. Cage, and they used that. They called all these detention centers cages, and they weren't like you'd put in wild animal. They were actually detention centers with rooms and interrogation rooms and so on, and cells and so on. But they called them the cage, and this one in London, was the most, well, the worst things took place there. And it was in a real fancy neighborhood, too. And they operated throughout the 40s. They started in 1940 with these things, and continued until 1949, long after the war was over, in complete secrecy. And thousands of Germans passed through the unit that became known as the London Cage, where they were beaten, deprived of sleep, and forced to assume stress positions for days at a time. But to go into some of the details, well, I'll just have to do one little thing after another. Some were told that they were going to be murdered and their bodies were going to be quietly buried. You know, they were threatened in this way. This is just the easiest part of it. They were threatened with unnecessary surgery carried out by people with no medical qualifications. One guy was told that one of his fellow prisoners was going to do an appendectomy on him the next day. The guy had no, you know, was not a doctor or anything. He was just going to be forced to do it. Things like that. And then the guards were picked, were chosen from the guardsmen's unit, which were, these people were chosen for their height. So they were all these real tall British guys, you know, they wanted the tallest ones of all to lord over these prisoners. And, they boasted that they were the English Gestapo. They boasted to the prisoners. Well, but the fact is, here's the thing I want. Yeah, the Gestapo did not behave as in the way that they're portrayed in Allied propaganda, even till now, and they did not behave the way these Englishmen did, in what we're talking about here. They were not. They did not do these kind of things.
Yeah. So
but they're all. But see, they're always saying that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
They were the manifestation of, or the reflection of what they had seen portrayed as the Gestapo in British propaganda. That's what you
get. Don't even know if they believed that or if they just used that. They, you know.
Oh, they probably did. They probably did. They, you know, people get fired up when they see this atrocity propaganda, and they feel morally entitled to do whatever the enemy, the amoral enemy, is doing. It only serves him right if you do it to him. That's the attitude.
Yeah. Well, that was certainly their attitude. And this, there was a network of 9 cages around Britain. London Cage was one of them. And they're under the jurisdiction of the Directorate of Military Intelligence, see? And, the person in charge of the London Cage, the top man, was Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Scotland. Isn't it funny? I've never heard of a person with the name of Scotland.
Yeah, that's a little bit suspect.
Yeah, what does that mean? Suspect how? I think he's Jewish? I don't know.
Well,
why would he name himself Scotland?
Yeah, it's a little strange.
Anyway, that was who he was, and he was highly, highly respected. And you know that the strange thing, though, that after the war he wrote a book. And he revealed a whole lot of what was going on about the way they ran the London Cage. And he said that some of them supposedly were more benignly run, but this London one under this Alexander Scotland was really terrible. And he said that they're giving a lot of description about London here. He had... I'll skip that. Well, no, he says that in this London Cage, which was at Kensington Palace Gardens, it was composed of 9 officers assisted by a dozen NCOs using whatever methods they thought necessary to squeeze information from suspects. So, you know, they had total freedom. Nobody was overseeing what they were doing. And this was during the war, started in 1940, so that, you know, they might have some excuse by saying they captured some Germans in France or, you know, pilots that came down or whatever, and therefore they needed to get information from them.
Yeah.
And so whatever they used, but it started in the summer of 1940, And this author, Ian Cobain, even though he's doing an awful lot of revelations here, he still has to say certain things that are loyal, you know, as a loyal British subject and so on. And so he says that at this time, German forces were racing across France and the Low Countries, and Britain was fighting for its very survival. The stakes could not have
Britain
been higher.
Britain was fighting for its survival. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. You know, so here's a big lie. You know, this is just a baloney. German forces were taking over France, that's for sure. They were winning. But they weren't... there was some talk of Britain being invaded, but it wasn't very... Well, you know what happened in Dunkirk. And then...
They were allowed to evacuate.
Yeah. Yeah. So Britain was never fighting for its survival, but it told the people that it was.
There was a remote chance that Britain would have to sue for peace if Gibraltar were seized, you know, through Spain, depending if Franco would cooperate with Germany and help Germany to take Gibraltar. And if then the Germans and Italians could push across North Africa and take the Suez Canal and close off the Mediterranean, then the Axis would have clear access to Africa and a very solid route for resources, and they could go down there and kick the British out of all their African colonies if they wanted to, whenever they had the leisure to do it. And I read something a couple of years ago that the intention was that if Germany and Italy managed to seal off the Mediterranean like that, then they would sue for peace.
Yeah, and all this time...
It was conceivable that would happen. It was never very conceivable that the Germans would come across the channel and invade.
That's right, because they didn't want to. And who wanted to, you know, administer all of that? They had enough...
But they just didn't have the naval power to do it. The Germans, they would have taken them several years to build up sufficient naval power to challenge the British fleet.
Yeah. Okay, and so this is just not realistic, but it says that
it's a long-standing popular lie, though.
Right, and during this time, maybe not when they were having those battles in France, but somewhat a little bit before, and certainly after all those victories in France and the Lowlands and so on, Hitler was sending, peace. Peace treaty solutions,
peace offers
to Britain, which were just straight across the board rejected. So
yeah.
Britain did not want peace, and of course the United States, as you already said, was in the background pushing all this along.
Yeah.
So then they say, so here were these they had these German prisoners that they thought they could do, they had to do anything they wanted to them, and now he makes another justification here. He says, you have to understand, you know, that in these following years, in the early 40s, during the war, large parts of Britain's cities were left in ruins. Hundreds of thousands of service personnel and civilians died. And barely a day passed without evidence emerging of a new Nazi atrocity. What evidence? I put in front of that word manufactured evidence. Barely a day passed without Britain's intelligence service manufacturing evidence of a new Nazi atrocity, right? So this somehow made it acceptable for German prisoners to suffer in British interrogation centers. Mm-hmm. So I think he's saying here to the readers, don't feel bad. Don't feel guilty. Britain had good reasons for what it did, even though it's going to be terrible what I'm going to tell you. But you know, you have to put it all in context.
I remember seeing, I guess it's on YouTube somewhere, a piece about a Luftwaffe prison where they had American and British flyers that had been shot down. And they did not use cruelty at all to get information out of their prisoners. What the commandant would do is he would take, if he wanted some information from a man, what he'd do is he'd go for a walk with him and be very nice to him and develop a rapport with him and then show him the consequences of Allied bombing. And then he could ask him for information and the man might give it willingly when he realized what he was doing.
Well, right, because the Germany was already in far worse shape from bombing than anything in Britain, which they try to exaggerate so much. So,
yes.
You know, if a few thousand British were killed, civilians, but how many hundreds of thousands of German civilians were killed? But somehow that's okay because the Germans started it. Well, that's just another lie that the Germans started it. But let me go on. Because I think this is important. And Cobain says, writes, and it should also be said that whatever went on within their walls, it paled into insignificance compared with the horrors the Nazis visited on millions of prisoners.
Yes.
See? That's another. See, that's how they do it. They come out with this stuff, and not all of it, because a lot of it is still top secret, but they come out with a lot, but then they'll put it into this context that, oh, it's nothing compared to what the Nazis did.
Yeah.
Well, but what did they do, you know? You know, the message here is whatever the British did, the Germans did worse. Whites are bad people. But what prisoners is he referring to when he says the horrors the Nazis visited on millions of prisoners? What prisoners is he talking about? Concentration camp inmates that were not British? Or is he talking about prisoners of war?
Oh, he's obviously talking about Jews there, because there were never millions of prisoners of war in Germany.
Right. That's my conclusion, too. So, you know, this is all baloney. But that's, now we can go into what he starts. Now he can start telling us about it, that he's made all those mea culpas there. So how can we be sure, he says, about the methods used at the London cage? Because the man who ran it, this Scotland guy, admitted it, but it was hushed up for half a century by an establishment fearful of the shame his story would bring on a Britain that had been fighting for honesty, decency, and the rule of law. Now, the man, Colonel Alexander Scotland, was supposedly an accepted master in techniques of interrogation. Now, in his 2005 or 2006 articles that he wrote, Cobain wrote this about him. He said, "The Scotland, a forceful, outspoken man, deemed to have the perfect background. Although English, he had served briefly in the German army in what is now Namibia, shortly after the turn of the century, and was later awarded the Order of the British Empire for his work interrogating German prisoners during the First World War. So he was already an experienced interrogator, and must have been pretty tough. So in 1939, he was 57 years old. He was recalled for service. So obviously he spoke German, and since he was in the German army for a while, I guess, and he understood. You know, he knew Germans better than
what. Namibia was German. Would have been German Southwest Africa probably at the time.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, that's from that now to the current article. After the war, though, he wrote a candid account of his activities. I think he must have been bragging. You know, I must have wanted to. Sometimes people just want to tell what they've been involved in.
Yeah.
In these memoirs, and he recalled how he would muse on arriving at the cage each morning, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here," because he said, if any German had any information we wanted, it was invariably extracted from him in the long run. So there's nothing that they wouldn't do to get information. And so often these Germans didn't have any information.
Well, yeah.
But they wanted to get it anyway to use it for their propaganda and so
on. See, that's the whole problem that I have with this waterboarding thing. It's a way to get people. It's a way to get the prisoner to say what you want him to say. Mm-hmm. Just so you'll stop the torture. It's not really necessarily a way to get the truth.
Well, exactly, and it didn't. It didn't, because as we go on, again now from Cobain's 2005 Guardian article, he wrote some information that wasn't in this one. He says, years later, Tony Whitehead, a consultant psychiatrist in Brighton, recounted in his memoirs how, as a young aircraftsman delivering a belligerent SS sergeant to the cage. Now, this would have been during the war, I think, not after. But the cage existed for a couple of years after the war, so I can't be sure when this was. But he was delivering this somewhat recalcitrant SS sergeant who wasn't cooperating to the cage. And when he got in there, he was shocked to see a German naval officer in full dress uniform on his hands and knees cleaning the entrance hall floor. An enormous guardsman stood with one foot on the prisoner's back, casually enjoying a smoke. Now, that's not the worst thing, you know. I mean, that's the way to humiliate and, you know, take people down and make them more cooperative, whatever. But it's when this guy Whitehead, Tony Whitehead, collected his prisoner 3 days later, the man was completely subdued, rarely looked up, and addressed him as sir. Whitehead said, "I do not know what had happened to him at the London cage." But, of course, you know, as I already said, these guards were selected for their height, for how tall they were. And he said rather than for their brains. But an inquiry later heard evidence that guards were under orders to knock on some prisoner's cell doors every 15 minutes, depriving them of sleep, and another which concluded with the possibility, quote, the possibility that violence was used, unquote, during interrogations. And then we get into Fritz Nauklein, which he wrote about already in 2005, and he's writing about again. This there was a long and detailed letter of complaint from one SS captain, Fritz Nauklein, who describes his treatment after being taken to the cage in October 1946. Now, this guy really tried. He didn't give in. I mean, he put up with tons and tons of punishment. And he was trying to get out say what was being done to him. But in the end, they hung him anyway. But this was now in 46. See, the war is over. And they're still, what they were trying to do with him was get him to sign a confession.
Oh, yeah.
And the confession was that he was responsible. He was the leader of a group let me find this now since I'm bringing it up. No, that's not where it is. Well, he was the leader of a group that had massacred 100 and some British troops that had surrendered or that they had captured. It's not clear that that story is true, but they wanted to find, you know, they wanted to punish people for it. So
they wanted to nail it down as a story to.
That's right.
Verify British real. Righteousness and German evil.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So let me get back to my place, which I lost now. So he said all the things that were done to him. When he got there, he was stripped. He was given only a pair of pajama trousers. He was deprived of sleep for 4 days and nights and starved. That was just the beginning. This was what was written in 2005. You know, I sort of stuck some of this stuff in here. Oh, I think I might have it down just a little ways. About him. Yeah, okay. He was a former lieutenant colonel. And they said he was a captain, but they say here now, he says now in the new article that this Nauklein was a former lieutenant colonel in the Waffen-SS. And he was suspected, you know, that's all they can say. He was suspected of ordering the machine gunning of 124 British soldiers who surrendered at La Paradis in northern France during the Dunkirk evacuation in 1940. And his defense was that he was not even there. But they were trying
that's
to get
a flimsy
this
excuse.
Yeah, they were trying to get him to confess. So he says during his trial, he had a trial, he said that he was deprived of sleep for 4 days and nights after arriving and forced to walk in a tight circle for 4 hours while being kicked by a guard at each turn. And he was made to clean stairs and lavatories with a tiny rag for days at a time while buckets of water were poured over him. If he dared to rest, he was cudgeled. He was also forced to run in circles in the grounds of the house while carrying heavy logs and barrels. And there was another guy who doing that with him at one point, I read later on. When he complained, the treatment simply got worse. And, of course, that's what they did. If you complain, if you say a damn thing, you know, well, they're just going to make it worse for you. So that's how they get them to just take it and never not say anything. He said it was not only him, but other men were repeatedly beaten about the face and had hair ripped from their heads. A fellow inmate begged to be killed because he couldn't take any more brutality. All Nocklin's accusations were ignored, however. At his trial, he was found guilty and hanged. So I don't know if he ever signed a confession or not. But, you know, Padding, if they were doing that to me, I'd break down after one day or 4 hours or something. Wouldn't take long. I just couldn't take that kind of stuff. Of course, men are tougher, but that kind of continual pain and beating and so on. So, all right. Now, sorry. Okay. Now it says that of 3,573 prisoners passed through this Kensington Palace Gardens, the London Cage.
How many was that?
3,573. And of that, more than 1,000 were persuaded to sign a confession or to give a witness statement for use in the war crimes prosecutions.
That's pretty good resistance rate there. 2 out of 3, more or less, held up and didn't do it.
Absolutely. Some of these SS men, particularly, were so tough, and they never would. And they died, you know. I mean, a lot of them died. I don't know. Is there a record of who these 3,573 prisoners are? I doubt it. I don't know. He doesn't say. Well, what happened to them? You know, maybe some of them. Maybe they were just of these one. Maybe these 1,000 were the ones that they thought they had a good case, a best case against, and so they really concentrated on them. Because not everybody was treated as bad, and some of them they just really, really put it on them. You know, because they were convinced that they were the ones they wanted to. To get their confession or whatever. So, now, let's see. Here's some more stuff. Okay, there was another group of men. There's another war crime they're trying to get confessions for. The shooting of 50 RAF officers who broke out from a prison camp, Stalag Luft 3. At what became known as the Great Escape. And somehow these were shot, these 50. Well, you know, the rules for prisoners of war, you don't try to escape. If you try to escape, you can be shot. Right?
Yeah, I think so.
I think so, too. And so, you know, I don't know what all the details of this were, but, of course, when it came to after the war, nothing that Germans did was okay, and everything they did was a crime, and nothing that the Allies did was a crime. You know, everything they did was could be explained because of war and so on. So, you know, I mean, the whole thing was just not fair. But they said it this Great Escape crime, war crime, of the 21 accused. 14 were hanged after a war crimes trial in Hamburg. Many confessed only after being interrogated by the Scotland, not, you know, the man named Scotland, was he James Scotland, and his men. In court, they protested that they had been starved, whipped, and systematically beaten. Some said, and they all said it, obviously, some said they had been menaced with red-hot pokers and threatened with electrical devices. Scotland denied the allegations of torture, going into the witness box at one trial after another to say his accusers were lying. And yet later, you know, it was all the more surprising then, Cobain says, that a few years later he was willing to come clean about the techniques he employed in his book. And in his memoirs, he disclosed that a number of men were forced to incriminate themselves. Forced. And a general. They had generals there. Just, you're not supposed to treat a general like this, you know? You're supposed to give them some kind of a, you know, decent lodgings and treatment and so on. But a general, German general, was sentenced to death in 1946 after signing a confession at the cage While in Scotland's words, he was, quote, acutely depressed after the various examinations. So when they wanted to get somebody, they did. Now, let's see. Going on from here. Now, here's another one with Scotland. A naval officer was convicted on the basis of a confession that Scotland said he had signed only after being subject to certain degrading duties. Well, maybe it was that naval officer who was scrubbing the entrance to the cage with the guard's foot on his back. Who knows? But Scotland also acknowledged that one of the men accused of the Great Escape murders went to the gallows even though he had confessed after he had, in Scotland's own words, been worked on psychologically. Mm-hmm. And this man, at his trial, insisted that he had also been worked on physically as well. But Scotland admitted that he'd been worked on psychologically. Others did not share Scotland's eagerness to boast about what had gone on in Kensington Park Gardens. An MI5 legal advisor who read his manuscript. Now, you know, he writes this, then he has to turn it in to have it look, you know, approved and so on by the intelligence departments. And they concluded that that what he said in there, he and his fellow interrogators were guilty of a clear breach of the Geneva Convention. So they couldn't allow that to be published because that would put everybody in jeopardy because they were guilty of not following the convention. And so we've got we're going to a break, but you know, Hanning, there's no difference between the British and the Soviet show trials, really. None. Nor the American and Soviet show trials. But we'll be back in 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen, to continue with this program.
Es ist einer dieser Tage, an dem wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang. Und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Erzählt von einer Zeit für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang. Und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich. Und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heretics Hour on the White Network with Carolyn Yeager, and my guest with me today is Hadding Scott, who you all know very well. And I've been doing a lot of talking here, but I'm trying to say what's in this article. And Hadding, as soon as I get through a couple of these other places where they kept prisoners, then we can discuss what it is about the British a little bit more.
Well, I just want to say, I'm not sure that it's accurate that you can, under the Geneva Convention, that you can execute an escaped prisoner if he's surrendering or if you already have him in your captivity again.
I don't know what they did. I was just saying that if they are escaping,
if they're in the act of escaping, you can shoot them.
Yeah, you can shoot at them. Yeah, yeah. But I guess that's not what they were saying they were doing. They said they were...
Yeah, well, the way they portrayed it in the movie, The Great Escape, is that they had recaptured them all and then pulled up a truck with a machine gun.
That happened?
Oh, I suspect that it's a distortion, of course.
Yeah, I just don't think the Germans just weren't, you know, what year was this? When did this Great Escape take place? At the very end of the war, or?
Probably like 1944.
Well, I just don't, basically the British prisoners of war were treated very well. I have records and there's websites where these guys, these British POWs have whole websites about their camp that they were at and what they did and all. And I mean, they were treated very well. So I don't know, some of this stuff is, I wouldn't say nothing ever happened, but, I really don't believe it. And they don't have enough evidence. They don't show anything. They got these confessions by these people who were tortured.
Wikipedia
says
3.5% of British captives in German custody died during the war, 3.5%. I would imagine that's mostly typhus deaths from the end of the war.
Yeah, 3.5% of all the British prisoners. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think you can say that about the Germans who were in the custody of the British or the Americans, maybe, and not even the French, maybe. A lot of them died.
Well, according to Wikipedia, it was very low. It was, I think it says 0.3%, something like that. But you see,
0.3%.
The USA
That's
and
really
Britain.
0.3%.
Yeah. The USA and Britain were not collapsing internally. It's never a good thing to be a prisoner of war in a country that is collapsing. You know, the prisoners at Andersonville Confederate Prison could tell you that.
Yeah, and these British and American people who were running how the war was conducted, they didn't care about that, did they?
Well, they could have avoided that by just accepting accepting an armistice, offering an armistice.
Yeah.
Instead of insisting on unconditional surrender, which means fight to the very end.
Which is why I talk about this German, this hatred against Germans in Germany by all of these people, all of these allies, to such an extent, it's almost it's hard to fathom, because they wouldn't do that, of course, because they wanted to crush Germany as a competitor, as a power, as any kind of a power forever, you know, and they've still got it under their control. Well, let's go on here. So
we're going to give out the phone number.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The phone number again, folks, is 1-830-443-4911. And let me look at my email. See if there's anything new here. No. Just junk. So let's see here. I have to find my place again. So, you know, since they knew that this was information that made them liable, even if you say that they wasn't okay to. I mean, it wasn't okay to treat them. They also had people. They made the prisoners stand for 24 hours at a time at attention. And they made them kneel while they beat them, you know, around the head and face and so on. And then I said how I gotta find my place here. How they pull their hair out and stuff. Okay, so here I am. So they were, the War Office and the Foreign Office both declared that it would never see the light of day, this manuscript that Scotland had written. And 2 years later, however, they are forced to strike a deal with him after he threatened to publish his book abroad. This guy didn't seem to be all that loyal. I don't know. He wanted his book to come out. And he threatened to publish it abroad. He was then told that he would never be allowed to recover his original manuscript, which he had handed in to them. But agreement was given to a rewritten version, in which every line of incriminating material had been expunged. So he had to rewrite it, and then they took out everything that was incriminating, and then the book was published. And it didn't make too much of a... It came out in 1957. It didn't make too much of a splash, I guess. I wouldn't know. But the War Office and the Ministry of Defense were still not too happy about the whole thing. And years later, now we move up to 1979, over 20 years later, Scotland's publishers wrote to the Ministry of Defense out of the blue, asking for a copy of the original manuscript that they had denied back then. The colonel was now dead, but they wanted it for their archives, they said. Well, this request triggered fresh panic. I don't know why they had to turn it over, but I guess these people had a right to it. There was under certain laws. And so they tried to deny it, but in the end, they quietly deposited a copy of, I guess, his original manuscript into the National Archives at Kew, where it went unnoticed, Cobain says, until he found it a quarter of a century later, after the year 2000 or so. And he says there's more to tell, but it's beyond reach because not all the files are available yet. So he's this is as much as they have. The cage was abandoned in January 1949, the London building, and then they, you know, the property was sitting around, and the Soviet Union used it for an embassy. And by 1955, the building had fallen into such disrepair it was sold to a developer who knocked it down and built three luxury flats and, worth millions. So that's that. And now back to his 2005 article, he wrote, by then the Red Cross, this is about the Red Cross trying to come there. The Red Cross was aware of the existence of the cage. I don't know exactly when. Oh, March 1946, a Red Cross inspector called twice at Kensington Palace Gardens. This was now, you know, after the war again, and they were turned away. In a lengthy memo to the War Office, Scotland explained why. He said that he had identified the officer who had disclosed the location inadvertently in a list of POW camps that were sent to the Red Cross. It wasn't supposed to be. They weren't supposed to know about it, but this guy had done it. And this guy had promised. Can you imagine this? This man had promised him that this blunder would not be repeated. I wonder what he did to that man. Imagine he didn't get off scot-free. Anyway, James Scotland went on to argue that he had to argue with his superiors that the Red Cross need not be admitted because his prisoners were either civilians or, quote, criminals within the armed forces, unquote.
Oh.
Yeah, they're still members of the armed forces, but they're criminal. They're considered criminals.
Yeah.
So they weren't protected by the Geneva Convention. And he said if the Red Cross were allowed inside the cage, he would instruct the RAF to stop sending him prisoners suspected of involvement in the Stalag Luft III murders. See, they were trying hard to find people that they could hang for that trial that was going to go on. So, and the RAF was sending him people that they thought were suspected. You know, I mean, these poor people, these poor Germans, they had no rights, they had no nothing. They were totally defeated, which is what the Allies wanted, so that they they could do whatever they wanted to them. And he says, Scotland wrote, the interrogation of these criminals must proceed in Germany, under conditions, they had some camps in Germany by then, under conditions more closely related to police methods than to Geneva Convention principles. So they were, again, they were using police methods and they weren't following the Geneva Conventions at all. And then he said, the secret gear which we use to check the reliability of information obtained must be removed from the cage before permission is given to inspect the building, you know, permission to the Red Cross. And he said this would take a month to complete. But, you know, they say, what is this secret gear which they were using to check the reliability of the information? They don't say, and I don't have any idea what they mean by that. Anyway, there was another secret interrogation center during and after World War II in London that was run by the MI5, it codenamed Camp 020, Camp 020 at Latchmere House, and it had 30 rooms that were turned into cells with hidden microphones. I think this is that place that we've had some stories about, the things they overheard on the microphones. I did a whole program about that, actually, practically. That doesn't amount to much. But they were taken there, and German spies who arrived, who they caught beginning in September 1940, they took them there to this place. And they used extreme methods. And in charge of this place was this really horrible guy, Colonel Robin Stevens, known as Tin Eye. He had a big monocle fixed to his right eye. He's a evil-looking kind of guy, but the object of interrogation...
Oh, they really are like the movie Gestapo, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. There's a picture of him there. He's really strange-looking. He doesn't look too... He looks like, you know, if he would greet these these prisoners coming in, he'd scare them to death right away, and I think he did. I think he did do that. But he said that the object of interrogation, he told his officers, but he talked too, see. He wanted to tell his story too. They wanted to get at truth in the shortest possible time. That was the purpose of their interrogation methods. Find out the truth in the shortest possible time. And they spoke of special methods. You know, they did not elaborate. Special methods. Doesn't that remind you of special handling that the Germans used, you know, in their documents? Now, you know, special handling has this evil connotation. Yeah.
That's only because they don't have the word kill anywhere in there. So you have to interpret everything as a code word.
Right. And but here they had just like in supposedly in the concentration camps, they had a 92 cell block and plus a punishment room known as cell 13, which was completely bare with smooth walls and a linoleum floor. Now at this place, 500 people had passed through supposedly of Camp 020. Principal among them were German spies. And they managed to turn many of these spies and have them work for them for MI5. And the first inmates there were members of the British Union of Fascists. See? The British Union of Fascists, they sent them there. And some were held in cells brightly lit 24 hours a day, others in cells kept in total darkness. They were subject to mock executions. And their doors were, you know, not their doors. They were knocked about by the guards. Some were apparently left naked for months at a time. Can you imagine? That's a way to make you feel like you know you're nobody. Camp 020 had a resident medical officer named Harold Dearden, a psychiatrist, who dreamed up regimes of starvation, or regimens should be, of starvation, and of sleep and sensory deprivation intended to break the will of the inmates. He experimented in techniques of torment that left few marks. And so that's that. Then, these techniques surfaced again after the war in a British interrogation facility at Bad Nenndorf, a German spa town. And some of the worst things were done here. You know, afterwards, they're in Germany. They have total control in their area, you know, their whatever that part that was British. And they all had total, they could do anything they wanted in Germany. And so they set up this camp for those who they considered a threat to the Allied occupation. You know, now they were occupying, and if anybody they thought might be any trouble whatsoever, they'd put them in a camp. And this one was a real bad one. 95,000 people were interned in the British zone. During in the 4 years after the war, not at this one camp, but it was they were interrogated by what was termed the intelligence division. And this Tin Eye Stevens, who was on attachment from MI5, was in charge of Bad Nenndorf, and he had been in charge of Camp 020 also. See, now they moved him to Germany, and an inmate recalled him yelling questions at prisoners and then punching them. I know they did that. They did that everywhere, you know. Over the next 2 years, 372 men and 44 women would pass through his hands. One German inmate recalled being told by a British intelligence officer, "We are not bound by any rules or regulations. We do not care a damn whether you leave this place on a stretcher or in a hearse." Doesn't this sound like what they say about the guards in the German camps, you know, "We don't care, you know, if you live or die, if you go up in smoke through the chimney, you know, we don't care anything about you." That's what they like to say was said to these people.
Well, yeah, that could be a line from a German, you know, from World War II movie.
Right, exactly. And this man who said this said that he was an inmate there. He said he was made to sleep on a wet floor. This just gives me the chills. To sleep on a wet floor in a temperature of minus 20 degrees for 3 days. I'm cold. I have such cold feet. I would be. Four of his toes had to be amputated due to frostbite. Well, my whole feet would have to be amputated, I guess. I would, you know, you're looking for a way to kill yourself, but you can't. They don't, you know, there's no way. A doctor in a nearby hospital that some of these men finally had to go to complained about the number of detainees brought to him, filthy, confused, and suffering from multiple injuries and frostbite. Many were painfully emaciated after months of starvation. A number died, and there's photographs. And I have one, I've got not the worst photograph I found, but I'm going to, I think, use this photograph, even though it's horrible to look at, of these four emaciated men who were prisoners at Bad Nenndorf. And this was, of course, meant to weaken, humiliate, and intimidate prisoners. What were they trying to do besides just break the will of any German that ever, you know, had any spirit in him? like the soldiers and so on and the officers. And also, well, I don't see how they had any concern about anything going on in Germany by then, but they just wanted to make sure that they were all beat to the ground. So a British Court of Inquiry was convened to investigate what had been going on, and it concluded that former inmates' allegations of physical assault were substantially correct. Stevens and four other officers were actually arrested.
Wow.
And Bad Nenndorf was abruptly closed because it had gotten out what they were doing there, how bad it was. And this was a quandary for the Labor government. The political fallout could be deeply damaging because there were other similar interrogation centers in Germany. This, you know, and they are all bad, but this one got found out. So there were urgent moves to hush things up. What?
That was run by the British.
Yes, yes, all run by the British. And but Stevens had a court-martial for ill treatment of prisoners. It was heard behind closed doors. They didn't want any of it to be public. He did not deny any of the horrors that had gone on because they had evidence of it. But his defense was that he had no idea the prisoners for whom he was responsible were being beaten, whipped, frozen, deprived of sleep, and starved to death. Now, this is, as the author points out, that this is the very defense that had been offered by Nazi concentration camp commandants. You pointed that out, too, at war crimes trials, for which that was not considered an excuse for any of them. But Stevens was acquitted. So even though they had got this guy, they acquitted him, and he got away. So the suspicion remains that he got off because of cruel... Well, of course this is true. I mean, absolutely. But anyway, Cobain has to say, the suspicion remains that he got off because if cruelties did occur at Bad Nenndorf, they had been authorized by government ministers. So they didn't want to actually find anyone guilty because these people had superiors who should be knowing what was going on, right? Mm-hmm. So they acquit them. And another thing...
suspicious of the British legal system. You know, they convicted William Joyce, who affected a British accent but was a U.S. citizen and broadcast from Germany during the war. They convicted him of treason, even though he was not even a British citizen or British subject. Somebody that's not a citizen of the country cannot commit treason against it. This was crazy, and it shows the crookedness, to my mind, of the British justice system, at least where certain powerful entities want things to go a certain way.
Well, yeah, and the British pride themselves on their great justice system, right? And they sort of began it. They were the first to give rights to their people and so on. Isn't that how their history goes? Hattie?
Yeah, I couldn't hear you for a second there. The sound dropped down.
Oh. Don't the British pride themselves on their great justice system and how it goes back, and they're the first of the Europeans to, you know, to give rights to their citizens and so on. And so, you know, but a lot of that you're saying is just not the way it really is.
I think I'm not an expert on it. I don't know a lot about it, but I've seen a few instances where it was very clear that in the British system, if the powerful people want things fixed a certain way, it's going to go that way.
Well, that's exactly how it goes. It's all the power thing. It's all the power thing. It's not that they don't have decent rights for their people in Britain. But if whatever they want to get away with, they're going to get away with it, and they're not going to follow the laws. And we know that nobody follows. They don't follow the laws in the United States either, or any country. Do the top people have to follow the laws? So anyway, the one thing is sure, that at this Bad Nenndorf, at least two German prisoners starved to death. Now, why are they starving to death there? They didn't feed them. You know, of course, they didn't want to feed the German civilians that weren't in prison. During that time, all Germans were practically starving, And these people were really starving. You should see the picture of this, this one guy. Oh, I never saw anything. Yeah. Even in the concentration camp pictures of typhus victims that looked as bad as him. Others were shot for minor offenses. That's been proven and so on. So, the final thing here is that, I think I mentioned this at the beginning, or I said it to you before the show, I'm not sure, but, that a 27-year-old German journalist, lodged a complaint. He was held at this camp, this Baden-Endorf, and he said he had spent 2 years as a prisoner of the Gestapo, and not once did they treat him as badly as the British did.
Sure.
Yeah, and I believe that absolutely. So this comparison with the Gestapo, is saying, well, nothing compared to what the Gestapo did.
Sure. According to propaganda movies that say what the Gestapo does.
Yeah, and just real quick, before we get into some... philosophical wrap up of all this. Here's some comments to this article, Chris. It's only a few of them, but it's the ones that were visible at the, on the page without going and looking at earlier ones or whatever. I don't know. But here, every one of them shows that these people are in denial about the whole thing. Lee Tyler from Newcastle says, I'm on the side that tortures evil people to save people's lives and will never change my mind on that. So all these German prisoners of war were evil people, and by torturing them, you're going to save British lives, I guess. Ignorant. Now here, PIX from Essex says, all war is dirty. People get killed. When your loved ones are in peril, most people would torture the enemy to make them safe. Of course, it shouldn't be like that, but it is.
Not every country needs to torture enemy prisoners in order to make them confirm their propaganda.
There you go. That's what it's really done for. It's not done to save, to protect your loved ones.
Yeah.
Now, Patty Leeds from Leeds says, there's nothing clean about war. Here's what people usually say. Good people have to do bad things to win. World War II was a dirty war, and for Britain to survive, had to plumb the depths to ensure we won, and war criminals were made to pay for their crimes today. We have the farce of being politically correct in a war zone, which get our soldiers killed. No, today we have the farce of being... She doesn't use any punctuation whatsoever in this.
Yeah, if they paid a little more attention to facts, British troops wouldn't be in a war zone today.
Well, that's right. It's just stupidity. Unbelievable. There's not a single intelligent comment here. John from Hull in the UK says, unfortunately, war is war, and I'm sorry, but what were they supposed to do? Come here, son. Let me take you by the arm and give you a healthy meal before I place you in our POW prison. In the meantime, every other soldier from other countries just do whatever they had to do, sometimes inhumanely, as history has written, it's war, for God's sake. Get a grip. And then Lisa says, they don't... Now, here she must be Jewish. I think she's Jewish. Mm-hmm. She's from Brighton. No, or maybe Elaine is, or both of them. She says, they didn't torture children, elderly people, and Jews just for the sake of it like the Germans did.
There you go.
Yeah, see? We defended our country from being taken over by the Germans. Well done to all who fought for Britain. Now, what does she know? She is really either just got an agenda, like some of these people do, or she's just totally ignorant and brainwashed.
Yeah.
And then John says, as they say, all is fair in love and war. That's another way that people want to just dismiss the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then Andy B says, one word, he says, justified. Everything that was done was justified.
Yeah, okay, so Britain's in better shape now because of that war.
Yeah, they should really learn a little something about what's going on in their country. But then this another guy says, guy with a funny name from Grantham, he says, there is and never will be a clean war. Anybody who even thinks there is such a thing needs to take off their rose-tinted glasses. Britain is just... Yeah.
I think the British, I think the German conquest of France in 1940 was pretty clean.
It was. It was. It was. They fought war the way war is supposed to be fought on the battleground, just fighting soldiers.
It was very quick and not a lot of casualties because it was quick.
Right. Well, Germany is never getting, or Hitler either, are never given credit for that, except for the fanatics who like them, except for the crazy Nazis. Who continue to want to be neo-Nazis and so on. But he says, this guy says Britain is just that much better at covering things up. And he's proud of that. We had plenty of practice.
It must be a totalitarian state.
Yeah.
Because supposedly the open society is not able to cover these things up.
Yeah. Yeah, and he says, we had plenty of practice whilst building our empire. In any war, there is a price to pay. And naturally, he spells there, T-H-E-I-R. I mean, all this stuff is, people don't have very good education. Sometimes that price is extremely unpleasant, but our freedom depended on a use of torture. Like it or not, and that is a very simple fact.
Yeah,
an eye for an eye, as they say.
from the prisoners there that helped British freedom, everything that those people were tortured about was about something that had already happened, probably.
Yeah, and they were tortured in order to confess, to sign confessions. And that was going to only harden the British attitude, these people's attitude, that the British were in the right and the Germans really did do a lot of terrible things, so they had to be punished. Then somebody just says that... She knew an old man who was a German POW who loved it here and stayed, says he was treated well and even married an English girl. Well, of course, there's a lot of those. There's some of those, you know. As we said, they weren't all. He was just a regular German POW, probably a regular soldier. And he got used to being here. So, here's another. Here's Elaine, the last one.
They even kept Germans as involuntary laborers after the war for a while in Britain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they did. So a lot of them were here for a while, and they weren't all treated so badly, and they just stayed because it was terrible in Germany. Why wouldn't a German who had met some, you know, British people, is working for them on their farms, whatever, and then has a, you know, falls in love with one of their daughters or something, a girl, and they get married, why wouldn't he stay? Why would he go back to Germany where everybody was starving and it was, it was in terrible shape? That makes sense. But Elaine says, compared to what the Germans done to the Jewish people, no comparison.
Okay.
So Hattie, how do you sum up why the British... You know, besides the fact that they need to protect their reputation for what they did during the war and that they got something, that they were heroes instead of damn fools and losers, what's behind it all?
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that the nature of propaganda in a democratic society where you have to inflame the population with accusations in order to get them to support the war. They can't just be passively going along with it. They have to be for it. In a totalitarian state, in an autocracy, the general public doesn't have to enthusiastically support a war. They just have to be willing to follow orders. In a democracy, they have to support it. Otherwise, they'll vote against the war first chance they'll get.
Well, but what makes them continue it? Their foolish pride. I mean, you know, they continue. How long? 45 to 2005, you know, 60 years, and now 65 years?
I think people hate to admit that they've been fooled.
Well, but how bad can people be to keep blaming those who shouldn't be, to keep doing this to people because they don't want to admit that they were fooled? There's some element of hatred of Germany by all of these allied peoples, the Russians, the French, the Americans, and the British, and then a lot of the other countries. They have it too. The Netherlands.
Well, it's interesting.
And some of the Scandinavian countries. They just have this anti-Germanism.
There's a language, an English language instruction video on YouTube, and you can find it by searching for "What are the Germans like?" And it has somebody, they're teaching real English, whatever that means, and using real examples of English. So they have this person with a microphone that goes around in Britain.
Asking
British people of various classes, what are the Germans like?
Right.
And they all give their different answers. And it's pretty divided. You have some people that think the Germans are wonderful and very worthy of emulation. Tends to be the more prosperous looking people that were like that. And then you have your other people that think that the Germans are very arrogant and rude and crude and boorish and loud and things like this. So there's a big division of opinion. Now, with the Daily Mail,
it probably depends on if they met one or two Germans, what they know about them.
Yeah.
Or else they're prejudiced, because I don't know that Germans are loud and, what you say, particularly loud and boorish.
Yeah, loud and boorish and rude.
Rude. Well, maybe me.
Arrogant.
Well, you know, most Germans behave pretty nicely.
They do have a reputation in Europe for being loud.
Loud.
I can understand that in France. When I was in France, I was a loud person because, you know, in France, you don't flush the toilet at night because that's considered disturbing. Right?
Because they live so close together.
Yeah, everybody in the house will hear it and they will wake up. I was never awakened by that sound. It was never enough to wake me up, but French people will wake up if you do that.
Huh. It's one of their cultural things.
So I'm as loud and rude and crude and boorish as a German, but so they probably, I suppose, so maybe they wouldn't seem that way to me as an American. Americans have a reputation for being, at least a Canadian said this to me once, brash Americans.
Well, I think that when it comes to white nationalism and pro-white people and white identity, which is the way they put it at Occidental Observer, and any of in this area, which we have to relate it to, I think that it's absolutely necessary that we get to the truth, accept the truth, and talk about this and get it out. But even these people don't want to do that. They don't want to do it. They're kind of Anglophiles, even if they're German ancestry, and even if they like Germans, they just say, well, let's just all come together, kind of like these comments. You know, it's not important anymore. You know, it's not important. What was done was done. It had to be done. But no, I think this is, you know, when I read this newspaper article, I just become enraged and terribly angry. And I don't think that any real Germans who care about Germany that still do, can ever accept this and can ever go along with it. And they're trying to do something about it, but it's a real struggle. And I think this is a big, big mistake in the white nationalist community. But I know that I'm in quite a minority, and most people don't agree with that. And this bothers me. It bothers me about, it makes me not want to support white nationalism, just to be real honest about it. And not want to support these groups and these people, and to devote all my attention to revisionism, historical and Holocaust revisionism.
Mm.
Because they're not, you know, I just feel that what I think is important is not being addressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, probably some people that would be happy to see you bow out of.
Yeah, I'm sure. I know that. Saying good, good. But I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that.
Oh.
I'm here at the White Network. I'm sticking around. But still, you know what I mean. I mean, I become real discouraged and I become disappointed in this whole movement because I don't think it's truth oriented. It's politically oriented. And now you're a big truth person, Hadding. It's politically oriented that how do we get a political advantage for whites? And it sure isn't by defending anything to do with the Nazis. You know, if I had time to switch over to the Occidental Observer, who is that? What is the woman's name? I know her name very well, but I can't think of it. Who is running for vice presidential candidate with Merlin Miller?
Virginia Abernathy.
Yeah, Virginia Abernathy. You know, she wrote a piece just recently in response to something that the Southern Poverty Law Center was saying about her. And she says,
She got called a racist by USA Today. And
okay, it was USA Today, all right. But she talked a lot about the Southern Poverty Law Center. But
yeah, I think they called
it,
her one.
But yeah, that's right. And she denied that she is racist. She denied that she is anti-Semitic. She denied, she said, I'm not a neo-Nazi. You know, she denied all these things, which is the common thing that's done.
I wouldn't call myself a neo-Nazi either.
Well, I know, but she means the whole thing, you know. She has no sympathy with that.
Yeah.
Well, neo-Nazi is a terrible word, of course, and
yeah, you know. Well, Nazi means buffoon in the Bavarian dialect, so I wouldn't call myself that.
Yeah. Well.
Well, what was your point about Virginia Abernathy?
Well, that she denies all these things.
Oh, yeah.
So that, you know, she's in some ways, you know, it's understandable, but in some ways she is then not standing up for what she says she stands up for and represents.
Well, what bothers me is this Pavlovian response to the word racist, which in terms of the objective content of the word, I don't see anything about it that should make me want to run away from it. A racist would be somebody that's concerned with race. And if A3P is not concerned with race, then what are they doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes I'll hear some Republicans say, the Democrats are the real racist. And I say, well, maybe I should join the Democrats. You know?
Yeah, because I also don't like that our people go along with the idea that racist is a bad word, that racism is bad, that they don't have anything to do with racism. And even in Virginia Abernathy's article, she kind of sets it out that she just wants whites to have their own, to have political power of their own. What am I trying to say here? I can't come up with the word. You know, within the whole picture where you have the Hispanics and the Negroes and this and that, we have to have our own spaces, our own places, our own power, but we're not going to own the nation. I guess I think that's too much to say. I don't know. You know, now, here, I really want to get at what's behind the British and why.
Okay, well, I can talk about that a little bit. Yeah, I was reading Brooks Adams' The Law of Civilization and Decay, which is about a theory of history. What he says is that you have two types of society. There's the imaginative society, which is populated by spiritual man. An example of that would be medieval Europe. And you have the economic society populated by economic man, although you will have an underclass of spiritual man in the economic society. The imaginative society degenerates into an economic society through centralization, because travel becomes easier, commerce increases, and people are able to become very wealthy in terms of money instead of being prosperous by producing food and objects for use locally. So you get these people that have money, and there's, you could call them the bourgeoisie, and you have your farmers and craftsmen who gradually lose power, because through the increase of the ability to travel, you get centralization of power and more and more centralization of wealth also. The economic society gradually robs the small farmer, the peasant, the yeoman of his ability to make a living. His labor is replaced with the labor of slaves, and the peasant himself may become a slave of some sort, or he might end up becoming a mercenary, or he might emigrate to resume his peasant existence somewhere overseas, which is probably why many of the English people came to North America. Mm-hmm. Since economic man rules by money, he fears anybody that exemplifies any other form of power, such as able soldiers. They also don't like an independent church. The Anglican Church represents the plutocracies. That's another word for the economic man, plutocracy. The plutocracy's co-optation of religion as a form of power. The Anglican Church, from its beginning, was essentially a political institution for controlling the common people. The dominant class in the economic society becomes more and more materialistic and amoral as time passes. And ultimately, the society becomes a congenial environment for Jews, who exactly. easily dominate such a society. Hmm?
Exactly. And what you're saying is Alfred Rosenberg pretty much says very similar things to that.
Well, yeah, there's a process of decay before Jews are able to become really powerful in a society. Adams, in fact, Brooks Adams, specifically mentions Rothschild in Britain as the culmination of Britain's descent into plutocracy.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Jews are old hands at being economic man.
Yes, exactly. They do represent economic man and technical man rather than creative, spiritual man.
Adams.
They're really not spiritual at all. Rosenberg.
Probably not. The God module in their brain is very small. That's why they have a small incidence of epilepsy among Jews. Small.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what Rosenberg says, and he goes into quite some good stuff about it. In which he argues exactly that they don't have that. So this whole idea that the Jews are such a spiritual people is baloney.
Now this is kind of interesting too. Adams implies that the selective pressures of the spiritual and economic societies produce men that are genetically different. He implies that. He doesn't really make an argument about it, but he says that the economic man that had replaced spiritual man as the ruling class in England seemed almost like a different race. It makes sense mm-hmm. that a different type mm-hmm. would prevail under those conditions.
Okay, right.
The effect of economic competition in England was to put small tenant farmers whose families had possessed the same plot for centuries into unemployment. The English Parliament addressed this problem through laws. The first English law for addressing unemployment said that an able-bodied beggar should be whipped until bloody, returned to his home, and whipped there also until he finds work.
That would take care of a lot of Jews who were, you know, going around, you know, haggling and their.
Well, this is about able-bodied
trade.
Beggars.
Yeah, I know, but they weren't beggars.
Since there was no welfare state, they had to resort to begging. Adams says that this law failed because there was no work to be had. Whipping these men didn't help them to find work. This is in the 1500s. Following that failure, says Adams, Parliament tried the experiment of killing off the unemployed. By the second act, vagrants were first mutilated, then hanged as felons. the preamble to the third act for ending vagrancy, which means not being employed, stated that since pauperism had not diminished, any vagrant brought before two justices was to be adjudged the slave of his captor for 2 years, the slave of his captor. He might be compelled by his captor through beating, chaining, or otherwise, be fed on bread and water or refuse meat.
And well, what's the point of this?
Hmm?
What's the point of this? I mean, this is
the cruel
their
treatment of English people by other English people.
Okay. Yeah.
Under plutocracy. And confined by a collar of iron about his neck. For his first attempt at escape, his slavery became perpetual. That really gives the master an incentive to try to encourage the slave to try to escape. Then he becomes a permanent slave. For the second attempt at escape, he was hanged. A common feature of the economic age, due to the diminution of the native peasantry, is the use of foreign mercenaries. Foreign mercenaries were even used to suppress peasant uprisings in England in the 1500s. There can be reactions against the advance of the economic age. According to Adams, the glorious revolution of Oliver Cromwell was a revolution of put upon peasants and minor nobles who were faring, people who were faring badly in the economic age. And I found this an interesting consideration. How many of us in this country are descended from representatives of spiritual man who left Britain following the eviction of the yeomen because there was no longer a home or a livelihood for them in Britain, or because it was very difficult there? And where in the United States are we to be found, the spiritual man? Where are they found in the greatest numbers? I would say a reasonable hypothesis is that the rural church-going Christians of the United States are largely descendants of refugees from the advancing economic age in Britain. The descendants of Irish and German immigrants would also be largely exemplars of spiritual man. It means that a majority of the white people in the United States would represent spiritual rather than economic man.
Well, let me read you. Can I? You want to finish?
I have a little more. Yeah. And the reason why this is important, that the most white Americans probably represent spiritual rather than economic man in their character, is that it makes them natural allies for Germany. The economic age arrived very fast in late 19th century Germany, so that a reaction was provoked while men of the older spiritual type were still strong and numerous enough to prevail, especially in South Germany. This reaction found its culmination in National Socialism, which explicitly sought to combat most of the changes that Adams describes. A considerable legacy of National Socialist economic and social policy lingers in Germany today. Americans, by their constitution, if they're anything like their ancestors, white Americans, if they're anything like their ancestors that came here, they should be constitutionally receptive to National Socialism.
We should be it's demonized so much. So you
get this constant propaganda.
Yeah. Well, here, Alfred Rosenberg in The Track of the Jew Through the Ages, a really good book. It's a short book, but it takes a while to read it. Page 94 and 95 says, to that is added in the case of the German, his proverbial, he's talking about the Jews and the Germans. He said, which he thinks are totally opposed to one another. The case of the German, his proverbial honesty and incorruptibility, which unfortunately has suffered much through war and revolution, and also his simplicity, clumsiness, and trustworthiness, all factors that have been always to the Jew a thorn in the eye, which he has always sought to undermine, about which he made thoughtless jokes and considered himself superior. As the classical saying of the Jew Auerbach expresses it, quote, this is what Auerbach said, we Jews are indeed the most intelligent race. Take a trashy Jew from Poland, clad in rags, and place the most intelligent peasant from the Black Forest in front of him, Ernst Sundel was from the Black Forest.
He's
Black Forest German. Whom would you decide in favor of? Certainly the Jew, for the German peasant is stupid. The most rotten Jew, on the other hand, is still a Jew. That is even today the instinctive or conscious avowal of all Hebrews. Yeah, so, you know, even if a Jew is rotten, he's still superior to a stupid German. Now, you know, I'm jumping to the Jews, but you know that Rosenberg talks, but he also talks about the British, too, in places. And I did have a whole little short essay where he had, but I don't have time for that. But he said, but Rosenberg says the Jew has always hated the German people. To be sure, he does not love the French and Anglo-Saxons either, but he feels much closer to them. He said German Jews are the bitterest enemies of German thought. So we're running out of time here. You know, the Anglo-Saxons have come a little bit closer to the Jewish way of thinking than the Germans. The Germans, I think, still, in spite of the fact that people think Germany is overrun by Jews, it's not. It's that they just have all this control because it's occupied by the United States.
Yeah,
and they can't do anything.
I think the Germans, I have a German friend that I talk to almost every day, and from what he tells me, the Germans are actually pretty rapidly getting back to being their old selves.
Oh, that's
because U.S. power is waning, and they know it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get things like this guy that was on the board of directors of Deutsche Bank coming out and saying that they need to think about the IQ of their immigrants and things like this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there is resistance, but it's kind of you know, the Germans don't make a lot of protest. They're probably going to vote Merkel. If they vote Merkel out, they'll vote in the Social Democrats. You know, I don't know how that's going to be an improvement. It's not. But it'd be nice to think that somehow all of this that I'm so concerned about, this historical narrative that's so false, that something could actually be changed about it in the not too far future. You think that's a possibility, Hanning?
I think our situation in the United States is worse than that of any European country. We just love to talk about how people in other countries have it worse than we do or have it so bad, but really we ourselves, we have to look at our own situation.
Well, that's actually the philosophy of the White Network and what I'm supposed to be doing, looking at, you know, at white Americans and what we can do about ourselves here. But I'm always interested in the German situation.
Yeah, well, we do need to get in touch with the truth, though, that's for sure, because you know we need to take a serious look at National Socialism, and that means getting past war propaganda.
Okay, very good ending. I agree with that wholeheartedly. Thank you very much, Hattie. And listeners, thank you for being with us tonight. This is another episode of the Heretics Hour, and we'll be back again next week. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.